The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Fortune Society recently held a webinar entitled Brutality Behind Bars, Accountability for Corrections Officers 2. We're going to hear portions of that event on today's show, but first, loyal listeners will recall that I live in Portland, Oregon. Ah, hell, enough said. First, here's U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat from Oregon, answering a question from a constituent during an online town hall meeting that was held Thursday, July 16th.
So, just a couple questions here. My first question is, I want to know what you can and are planning on doing about the federal officers that have been deployed to the Portland Black Lives Matter movement. I've seen a lot of really disturbing images and stuff that doesn't seem entirely legal to me. So I'm wondering what actions you can take on that. And second question, I saw that you plan to do a constitutional amendment to ban prison labor. And I'm a big fan of this and want to know how that's going and how I, as a constituent, can help.
Great. Well, let me start with the first part, which is the federal officers. And Senator Wyden and I have expressed a lot of outrage and concern over the deployment. And I'll just speak for myself, very concerned that it's inflaming the situation, making it much harder to de-escalate the confrontations that are occurring on a nightly basis in Portland. I was on the phone earlier with Acting Deputy Director of the U.S. Marshals. His name is Derek Driscoll. I wanted to know how many people were deployed, what their command structure was, who makes the decision for how they act, what are their rules of engagement. He said he couldn't share anything about their rules of engagement other than they have a manual that every officer knows about. I said, yes, but you have operational protocols that change according to the situation you're in. Who's making those decisions? Who's in charge? He would not say who was in charge. I do not know if the pictures of the people in camouflage with no markings, except some of them say police, were actually U.S. Marshals. We're trying to find out. I asked specifically if they were authorized to use the rubber bullets, impact projectiles, and what the rules were on that. All I got was, well, they have a manual and they have training, and well, yes, but there was no answers. And the situation where Donovan LaBella was holding up a sign and was shot in the head, anyone who hasn't seen that video, it is horrific. And it's just an example of what should never happen in America when people are peacefully protesting on the street, making their points known, and be attacked in this fashion. And that the U.S. Marshals will not give us answers about how they're operating, who's in charge, what their protocols are, is completely unacceptable. And in regard to this showing up, and I don't know if this was the Marshals, but whoever's showing up and has no identification on who they are, that happens in authoritarian countries. That should never happen in a democratic republic where you're accountable to the people. So I hope we can pass some kind of law to ban the no-name authoritarian presence. So I think that we need to send these federal deployments that are causing more escalation and difficulty back. Trump sent them in a very political way to begin with, which did not help at all. It poured fuel on the fire. And I think we need to do all we can to send them home, send them back wherever they came from. I guess that's the bottom line. And you asked me about the 13th Amendment. The 13th Amendment, there's a documentary called The 13th. I encourage everybody to watch. It's powerful. It's a chapter of American history that is not generally taught in our schools, at least wasn't taught when I was in grade school or high school. And that is after the Civil War. So the 13th Amendment ended slavery, but it has an exception clause in it. And it says, except for someone committed for a crime. In other words, slavery is still legal if you're committed a crime. At one time, Alabama was arresting so many black men and then running out their services to plantations. It was almost as if the Civil War never happened. And they were funding some 75-80% of their government off this process of this legalized slavery post-Civil War, post-13th Amendment. So that involuntary servitude exception that applies to rest, it motivated some towns to go out and just sweep black men off the street in order to turn them back into slaves. So it's a very dark, horrific history. I'm introducing a constitutional amendment that would change the 13th Amendment and remove that clause. And anything anyone can do to publicize that and encourage that would be great. It's a horrific sentence that needs to be deleted from our Constitution.
That was U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley addressing constituent concerns during a town hall meeting held Thursday, July 16th. Now, here's Portland activist and organizer Teresa Rayford speaking at a rally that took place in Portland on Friday, July 17th. Audio comes to us courtesy of Portland Jobs with Justice.
Thank you for caring about our community. Thank you for showing up. But I wanted to just say that we started this movement when President Obama was still in the White House. We knew that we were stolen people on stolen land through genocide, and that same patriarchy system was coming for us and anyone else in this community that was a part of the 99. When our movement started, it was to combine our communities so that we could build solidarity against the machine that only eats our children. We've been quantified, we've been criminalized, we've been detrimentally lied to by our politicians that we stood up and stayed in contact with to make sure that they were elected because we trusted them. They have let us down to the detriment of public safety at this point. The fact that they're speaking out now does not take away the fact that they have not spoken out before. It does not make good the fact that they have never responded to us. It does not make good the fact that they knew we were out here screaming for our lives and that they never showed up to stand up in solidarity for black lives. The fact that they care now, because Donald Trump's military forces in our city, only undermines our intellect because we know that they're trying to get elected. The fact that we know who they are, we should show them where we're going in November, period. The city belongs to the people. The will of the people is how the city operates. When we come together, the city moves in a way that protects the safety and the future of our children, not property. Property does not matter during a pandemic when people are dying because of a critical crisis. Attacking our solidarity and our mutual support of one another while maintaining an opportunity to poison us is irreparable harm. We should all be aware of what the information in the science report that we put on Don't Shoot Portland means and how that should accommodate any kind of opportunity you need to stand up and get justice. Look at the report, read the report, share the report, and at the same time, if you've been harmed at any time during this pandemic, please contact us so we can fight for you. We show up for our community. All lives do not matter until black lives matter.
That was Teresa Rayford, an activist and organizer in Portland, Oregon. She was speaking at a Black Lives Matter rally on Friday, July 17th. This is Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
As I mentioned at the top of the show, the Fortune Society in New York held a webinar recently entitled Brutality Behind Bars, Accountability for Corrections Officers Too. We're going to hear a portion of that webinar now. The speakers are Jai Diamond, New York Criminal Justice Agency, Assemblyman David Weprin, Chair of the New York State Assembly's Committee on Corrections, Karen Murtaugh, Executive Director of Prison Legal Services, Donna Hilton, Executive Director of A Little Piece of Light, and Philip Miller, Associate Director of Policy at Correctional Association of New York. The next voice you hear will be that of the moderator for this webinar, Andre Ward, Assistant Vice President of the Fortune Society's David Rotenberg Center for Public Policy.
You know, I want to make sure now, I just want to get just everyone's like call to action, some things people can start doing, right? Some ways to look at different reforms. You know, Assemblyman Weprin, you know, you've had some legislative wins that have been obviously successful in many different ways. To Karen's point, however, there's still some areas that need work, right, that we have to begin to change. You know, starting with you, Assemblymember Weprin, what are some of the things, some of the reforms that you think, some other reforms that can happen, possibly in corrections, in docs, to prevent abuses in that way? I know we have, obviously, we have cameras now in prisons, right? We have some body cameras specifically in some of the prisons, but that's not enough, obviously, because those cases are still emerging. Just from your thinking, Assemblyman Weprin, what are some of the other things that we can do to really address this issue of abuse and have real accountability and transparency? Thank you, Assemblyman Weprin.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a lot more we can do, but as it is now, we haven't, you know, we haven't done enough, even with the body cameras, as Karen pointed out. You know, for correction officers, you know, having the body cameras very important, as well as, you know, having cameras in all the facilities. We're actually one of the bills that came out of committee last week. That is going to the floor, hopefully this week, that I'm hoping to pass, is based on something Philip Miller mentioned earlier with the Correctional Association, how important it is to allow the Correctional Association to have access to the facilities and to outside of the personnel of docs. Whenever I have a visit to any state facility or local facility, I always meet with the ILC, the Inmate Liaison Committee, and I always insist that it be out of the presence of docs employees, because as was pointed out, you know, if incarcerated individuals feel, you know, that docs is listening, or the correction officers are listening, or the superintendent, or, you know, officials at docs are listening, they're going to be very hesitant to be honest and to talk openly. And that's probably the most important part of my visit, is to have those meetings with incarcerated individuals, with the Inmate Liaison Committee, with some of their issues that we bring to the attention, you know, of the superintendent, and have had changes as well. So this particular bill that we came out of committee last week would allow the Correctional Associations to have the same right as they examine facilities, and they have been doing for, you know, as somebody points out, they've been around for 175 years. You know, they don't have the right to have, you know, visits unrestricted without having docs employees there in their presence. So that's one of the bills that we have that I hope to pass this week, which would allow the Correctional Association to meet with incarcerated individuals out of the hearing of docs officials and to actually make changes and listen to suggestions. So you know, it's legislation like that. One of the other bills I'm going to be doing this week, and it becomes even more important in light of the pandemic and the fact that visitation was virtually ended, cut off completely, you know, during COVID-19, and I'm hoping it'll be easing up shortly, is to require seven-day visitation in all facilities, minimum, medium, and maximum. And that came out of my first budget as chair of the correction committee a few years ago, and I think it was in 2017, when the governor was trying to save about $2 million in a $2 billion correction budget by cutting visitation in maximum security facilities from 7 days to 3 days a week. And then during that battle, and we had all the advocates, we had press conferences, we had thousands of demonstrations, we had a kind of our own a little movement among, you know, incarcerated individuals' families, and we were very successful in that, where the governor actually withdrew that cut in the middle because of the protests, because of the public support. You know, that seemed like a small thing, but then I realized, you know, there's no 7 day visitation in minimum or medium security, that they can limit visitation, and generally it's limited to weekends. So I said, it doesn't make any sense why you should be able to have 7 day visitation in maximum security facilities, but not medium and minimum. So I'm hoping that that bill will finally pass this week and be signed by the governor.
Sure. Thank you, Assemblyman Weprin. And, you know, there's been conversation, and people have been lifting up the idea of having what would be considered an independent review board, right, for some of the abuses, some of the things that are happening, because to use oftentimes the state measures to engage and hold people accountable is just not enough. So, Karen, like, talk to us a little bit about, like, thoughts on that, right? Like, an independent review board coupled with some other recommendations around reforms to address accountability and transparency and brutality that are occurring in the jails and prisons.
Thank you for that question. It's incredibly important. I do believe there is a correctional ombudsman bill out there that's floating around, but I don't think it's gone anywhere yet, but that's pretty much what it would be. A couple years ago, the legislature held hearings on oversight, and I testified along with a number of other people about the need to have some independent agency organization that has full and complete access and oversight of DOCS. The Correctional Association is wonderful, but they are limited statutorily in terms of what they can do and what information they get. I mean, that could be broadened to give them the authority. But I think we need such an agency or organization, and it should be outside of the politics of it all, because what's happened in the past with things that are done like that is that if a different person becomes governor or the legislature flips, then those organizations get defunded. And even though they have the authority to perform oversight, they don't have the resources to do so. So I think when you look at doing something like that, you have to be very careful about how it gets set up and structured, so it is a standalone, independent organization that will be impacted ever so slightly by politics. So I think that's number one. Number two, I think that there's a number of bills that are out there. There's the Less is More bill for parole. There's the elderly parole bill. There's the HALT bill, which would severely limit solitary confinement. There's the Fair and Timely Parole Bill. There's the Minimum Wage Act. There's which would raise the salaries for incarcerated or the wages for incarcerated individuals for all the work they do. And let me just say here that we've received so many letters from incarcerated individuals that wanted us to get the word out that they were so proud to be helping during COVID-19. There was a lot of criticism that they're, you know, we're not paying what we should be paying, that hand sanitizer in the beginning wasn't even available in the prisons. And all that was true and accurate and criticism that should have been out there. But at the same time, there were a number of individuals working so hard to make masks and make hand sanitizer. And they wrote to me and they said, you know, I just wish people knew that we care about New York State and people that live here, and we're doing everything we can to help. So people should know that. But I think that if you look at all of these bills that are out there, from all the parole bills to the minimum wage to HALT, the underlying issue that makes those bills necessary is the continued racial disparity and racism that we have in this state and in this country. And the New York Times wrote about it in 2016, and they had a series of articles about the racial disparity in our prisons. And it's not just in the prison, then it's within the prison. It's who goes to solitary, who doesn't get paroled, who doesn't get those, you know, the certain programs or educational opportunities in prison that will help them successfully reintegrate into society. So along those lines, I received a letter a couple weeks ago from a guy in one of our state prisons. And he said, you know, I don't understand it. We've done so much on rape and sexual abuse in prisons. We have the Prison Rape Elimination Act. We have a lot of focus on that. Why aren't we doing more about racism? And, you know, it got me thinking, and I wrote a letter to the commissioner. I sent a copy actually to Assemblyman Weffern, so he's seen it, but about focusing on that. And it has to come from the top down. But I mean, it could be called the Prison Racism Elimination Act. And there could be an entire effort of the state to focus on racial disparities outside and inside prison, and all the things that happen in prison that are from racism. So, you know, and so we can pass all the bills we want to pass, and maybe we can improve parole. Maybe we can reduce solitary confinement. Maybe we can increase wages. But until we address the underlying problem of racism, I don't think we're going to make our prisons that much better or our communities that much better.
Right. Because some maintain, Karen, that the criminal justice system is simply a byproduct of the racism that exists societally, right, in society. And that's really important. And we know that in addressing brutality within prisons, right, it's also a matter of like addressing leadership and a matter of political will too. And this is no way it suggests to point to you, Assemblyman Weffern. We know you're on the ground like doing some great work, but obviously there's others who you'll need to be in partnership with or to support you in advancing the things that will address some of the abuses in prisons and jails. And, you know, Diamond, I want to circle back to you. We're going to open up the chat for a couple of questions to be answered. But, you know, Diamond, as a Latinx trans person, right, who's obviously had these experiences, what are some of the things that you'd like to share with our panel as it relates to how trans folk are treated in prisons and jails? What clarion call could you put out there for people to support changing the conditions that people who identify as trans are experiencing in jails and prisons?
Right. So I just want to clarify, I am white and Black. I'm not Spanish. I know it can be a little confusing. I get it. But a great question. I do strongly feel that the employees of corrections that are there to protect the individuals in which they serve need to reflect the communities that they are there to protect. I do not feel safe when I am whitewashed. I do not feel safe when I am sent through a system in which I know these people who don't look like me are against me. However, everyone looks like that person. I don't feel safe when there's nobody who I can turn to and feel like we can relate. I think that unless these things change, right? Like Karen said, unless there is systematic racial change, unless people understand the importance that unless racism no longer exists, these problems will still exist. These problems will continue, right? Because as women know, as men who are incarcerated know, as trans people like myself who are incarcerated, we all have varying difficulties. Not to say that my struggles are different from Donna's struggles or that Donna's struggles are different from Philip's struggles, right? They're the same. They're just different in how they affect that person and the communities of those people. I'm a strong believer that DOCS needs to employ outward change within its employees and who they hire and how they can show themselves to the population in which they serve. Trans people every day incarcerated are being harassed. They are being disparaged. They are marginalized and misunderstood. They're being attacked. When I walk past an officer and he tells another inmate to burn down my cube where I have to live, I no longer feel safe. Right? When I'm a victim in 2016 of sexual assault and the inmates say we are going to lie for the police because we don't want you living here, I am a victim. I no longer feel safe. When for that same incident, I spend 90 days in the box without a ticket. And after 5 days, my attacker gets to walk out of the box. I no longer feel safe in the entirety of DOCS. I don't care which prison I'm in. I don't care who's in front of me. And I'm sorry if I'm upset at everyone who I come into contact with. I'm sorry if you think that I'm an angry person. I'm sorry if you feel like I'm not getting transitional services. But I'm not, and I can never. Unless I learn and have the strength, which unfortunately so many people, trans people, women, men of varying backgrounds and ethnicities, right, don't have. I'm lucky that I do. And I'm lucky that fellow people who have gone through the system have that drive within them, right? These are the people just that haven't been broken by the system and or life, right? And this is sad. So again, I have to reiterate, unless the dialogue changes, unless the narrative speaks on employees who reflect the communities in which they're there to protect, there can be no change.
And thank you for that, Jai. Diamond, we appreciate that too. And I know someone asked the question about what is the definition of racism. I'll give a very loose definition, right? And so, at least from my vantage point, you know, the definition of racism has all to do with power and privilege and the ability to use that power and privilege to negatively impact the lives of other human beings, right? So that's a loose definition, and others have definitions as well.
That was a portion of a webinar entitled Brutality Behind Bars, Accountability for Corrections Officers 2, that was organized recently by the Fortune Society. You just heard Jai Diamond, New York Criminal Justice Agency. Assemblyman David Weprin, Chair of the Committee on Corrections of the New York State Assembly. Karen Murtaugh, Executive Director of Prison Legal Services. Donna Hilton, Executive Director of A Little Piece of Light. And Philip Miller, Associate Director of Policy at Correctional Association of New York. The moderator of the panel was Andre Ward, Assistant Vice President of the Fortune Society's David Rotenberg Center for Public Policy. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Be sure to check out Dean's new video project, Becker's Buds. You can find links at drugtruth.net. Drug Truth Network programs are available by podcast. The URLs to subscribe are also on the network homepage, drugtruth.net. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.